From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the show, we visit the beautiful island of Key West in the southern U.S. state of Florida. But first, we report on the latest dietary guidelines in the United States. Many people in the country are happy to hear that eggs are back on the table. American officials announced new nutritional guidelines for the United States last week. As always, some suggestions are well received, others not so much. Ana Mateo has our report.
Americans can eat eggs without feeling guilty, according to new nutritional guidelines issued by the U.S. government. A person can eat as many eggs as they like each day, the updated guidelines say. One large chicken egg has about 186 milligrams of cholesterol, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Most of that is in the yellow center, or the yolk. Older guidelines restricted cholesterol intake to 300 milligrams a day. Two eggs would be more than the daily limit. The guidelines were issued by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Human Services. The government guidelines are issued every 5 years. It is designed to help set nutritional standards for school lunch programs and federal food aid. The new guidelines cautioned that individuals should eat as little dietary cholesterol as possible. In the past, guidelines have led to reduced sales and hurt agricultural markets. In 1977, the guidelines recommended avoiding cholesterol. That recommendation led to a decline in egg sales. Other tips to stay healthy included advice to limit intake of sugars to 10%, saturated fat calories found in red meat, butter, cheese, whole milk, and ice cream should be limited each day to 10%. The guidelines also suggested Americans move away from a diet full of animal protein and sodium. The guidelines promoted eating more fruits, vegetables, and nuts. The government has long recommended eating breakfast each day as a way to stay fit. The latest guidelines do not recommend that breakfast is necessary. Some are critical of the new guidelines. Mayo Clinic's Dr. Donald Hensrud told Time magazine that the new recommendations do not address weight management. Hensrud also mentioned that the recommendations failed to note the positive reports of how coffee decreases the risks of diabetes and Parkinson's disease. Harvard professor and physician Walter Willett was candid in his observations. This is a loss for the American public and a win for big beef and big soda, Willett said. The problem isn't just that the public gets misleading, censored information, but that these guidelines get translated into national food programs. This then gets directly translated into unnecessary premature deaths, diabetes, and suffering. Of course, this goes on to mean greater health care costs for all. It is all connected. I'm Ana Mateo.
It is cold in much of America right now. Parts of the country are buried under snow. Other parts are flooding. Now, Jonathan Evans tells us about an American island where you can escape the winter blues.
If you're dreaming of a white Christmas, don't go to Key West. As winter spreads over the northern United States, tourists and retired snowbirds are heading south for warmer weather. Key West, Florida, with its tropical weather, white sand beaches, and lively nightlife is a popular escape. The island's motto is close to perfect and far from normal. Key West is part of the Florida Keys, a string of tropical islands off the southern tip of Florida. It is about a 3-hour drive or 30-minute flight from Miami. Key West is the end of the road in geography and in spirit. It is connected to the mainland of the United States by a series of bridges called the Overseas Highway. The island is known for its liberal and tolerant culture. It has long attracted artists and writers, along with people who want to escape mainstream American culture. The local people, known as conchs, have a spirit of independence. A conch is a type of seashell that has become a symbol of the Florida Keys. In 1982, the U.S. government set up a roadblock on the Overseas Highway. Federal police stopped cars looking for drugs and illegal immigrants. Island residents were angry because the roadblock made travel difficult and hurt tourism. To protest, the Florida Keys declared their independence on April 23, 1982. Key West Mayor Dennis Wardlow declared himself the Prime Minister of the new Conch Republic. Part joke and part protest, Wardlow declared war on the United States. He surrendered after 1 minute. Today, the flag of the Conch Republic flies all over the Florida Keys next to the American flag. Although they were never independent, residents of the Florida Keys celebrate their Independence Day every April 23rd. The roadblock is gone. Key West might seem like paradise, but it has problems like anywhere else. This is truly the end of the road, local resident Catherine Baxter said. People come here to get away from things. Baxter, a case manager at the local hospital, sees a side of Key West that tourists rarely see. Drug and alcohol abuse are serious problems here. Monroe County, where Key West is located, has the highest suicide rate in Florida. The extremely high cost of housing has left some people homeless. A modest one-story house here can easily sell for $1 million. But most of the jobs in Key West are low-paying jobs in hotels and restaurants. Some longtime residents are leaving the island, fed up with drunk tourists, low wages, and high living costs. Key West's most famous resident was the brilliant but troubled writer Ernest Hemingway. Hemingway is one of the most important American writers of the 20th century. Ernest and his wife Pauline lived in Key West from 1931 to 1939. The house, a Spanish-style mansion, was a wedding gift from Pauline's father. In this house, Hemingway wrote some of his most famous stories, including The Snows of Kilimanjaro and To Have and Have Not. Hemingway had a cat with 6 toes named Snow White. Today, about 50 of Snow White's descendants live on the grounds of the Hemingway house. Some of the cats have 6 toes. No trip to Key West is complete without trying its famous dessert, key lime pie. Key limes, which grow in Florida, are smaller and less sweet than Persian limes. Key lime pie is made with key lime juice, egg yolks, and condensed milk on a graham cracker crust. The dessert is topped with cream made from egg whites. These days, it is popular to serve key lime pie frozen on a stick, dipped in chocolate. You can find key lime pie just about anywhere in the Florida Keys. Kermit's Key Lime Pie Shop on Elizabeth Street is the most famous. In 2006, the Florida State Legislature named Key Lime Pie the official pie of Florida. A short walk from the Ernest Hemingway House is the most photographed site in Key West. It is a marker showing the southernmost point in the United States. Tourists wait in long lines to take pictures in front of the monument. It reads, 90 miles to Cuba.
And that's our show for today. I'm Katie Weaver. Join us again tomorrow for another As It Is.
Hello and welcome to Words and Their Stories, a VOA Learning English program about American expressions. The Greek poet Homer has given us many phrases. A famous one is Achilles' heel. On your body, your Achilles' heel is the tendon on the back of your ankle. In spoken English, your Achilles' heel is your weak spot. You can say either Achilles' heel or Achilles' heel. Both are correct. The Greek story of Achilles' heel is the one Homer tells in the long poem called the Iliad. Here is how the story goes. When Achilles was a baby, his mother bathed him in the river Styx. She believed the river had magical powers. Bathing her son in its waters, she thought, would make Achilles immortal, deathless, like a god. But one part of his body did not get wet, his heel, where his mother held him. His heel, therefore, was the one spot where Achilles could be hurt. Achilles grew up. He became a great warrior. During the Trojan War, he fought with the Greek army. None of the Trojan weapons was able to hurt Achilles. The god Apollo, however, knew of Achilles' weak spot. Apollo told the prince of Troy, named Paris, all about it. While not actually written in the Iliad, legend says Paris shot an arrow at Achilles' heel and killed him. We all have an Achilles' heel. Even the toughest among us has a weak spot. This weakness may change as we get older. For many young people, their ego or overconfidence could be their Achilles' heel. For others, perhaps greed is their Achilles' heel. If I am trying to lose weight but love to eat ice cream, you could say that my love of ice cream is my Achilles' heel. And for many people, love is their Achilles' heel. Love leaves us helpless. Love makes us weak. People in love may find themselves doing foolish things. They may open themselves up to hurt or embarrassment. And a person who is head over heels in love is really in a weak position. This phrase, however, does not come from Greek literature. It was first used in the 14th century to mean turning a cartwheel or somersault. Today, head over heels means something that is not in its natural state, or something that is felt very deeply or strongly. It is usually used to describe someone who has fallen, possibly foolishly, in love. Head over heels gives a clear picture of one who has fallen deeply and passionately in love. Close your eyes and picture what a person may look like if he or she is spinning like a wheel, turning over and over. That is head over heels. Let's hear this expression used in an example.
Hey, have you noticed something different about John recently?
What do you mean?
Well, he is usually such a good student, but lately he never has his assignments done, and He seems unable to focus in class.
Well, you know he has a new girlfriend, and he is head over heels in love with her.
Oh, that explains why he has been acting so strange lately.
Perhaps being head over heels in love has never been your Achilles's heel. But you can probably imagine how powerful the feeling is. Like in this song, by Tears for Fears, something just happens, and you are head over heels. I'm Ana Mateo.
I'm Shirley Griffith.
And I'm Christopher Cruz with the VOA Special English Program, People in America. Today, we tell about Sally Ride. She was America's first female astronaut.
June 18th, 1983. Sally Ride was one of five astronauts on the American space shuttle Challenger.
And liftoff of STS-7 and America's first woman astronaut. And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
Hundreds of thousands of people came to Cape Canaveral in Florida to witness the shuttle launch. It was the second flight for Challenger and the first shuttle mission with a five-member crew. During the flight, the astronauts deployed two communication satellites and performed scientific experiments for NASA, the American Space Agency. Sally Ride was in space for almost 6 days. After returning to Earth, she said, "I'm sure it was the most fun I'll ever have in my life." Years later, she talked about the launch.
The training really doesn't prepare you for launch morning. That I spent an enormous amount of effort just trying to stay focused. I tried to block out pretty much everything that was going on around me and just kind of put one foot in front of the other and do as mechanically as I could all the things that I knew I had to do that morning and that I was prepared to do, because it would have been way too easy to just be lost in the moment.
Sally Kristen Ride was born in Encino, California on May 26, 1951. Sally was a good athlete. As a child, she excelled at playing tennis, but she was also interested in science. Many years later, a business she created said she grew up playing with a chemistry set and a telescope. Sally Ride also was very good with young people, so it is probably not a surprise that she became a teacher after her career in space had ended. She remembered that when she was a young girl, a teacher let her class watch the launch of a spacecraft on television. It was then, she said, that she knew she wanted to go into space. Sally Ride attended Stanford University in California. She received two bachelor degrees in 1973, one in physics and one in English. She earned a Master of Science in Physics in 1975 and a doctorate in astrophysics in 1978. She completed all of her studies at Stanford University.
In the late 1970s, Sally Ride saw a job advertisement in the Stanford student newspaper. NASA was seeking people interested in becoming an astronaut. Until then, astronauts had been military test pilots, and they were all men. Space agency officials had begun looking for scientists and engineers, not just pilots. She answered the advertisement, and in 1978, became part of NASA's first class for astronauts that included women. She and five other women and 29 men were chosen from among more than 8,000 applicants.
In astronaut training, Sally Ride learned to fly a jet airplane and jump from the sky wearing a parachute. She also learned how to deal with weightlessness and survive in the water. Sally Ride's historic spaceflight came 5.5 years after she was chosen for the space program.
The fact that I was going to be the first American woman to go into space carried huge expectations along with it. And that was made pretty clear just the day that I was told I was selected to the crew, because not only did I talk with George Abbey, who informed all the other crew members, but I was also taken up to Chris Kraft's office, who was the head of the Johnson Space Center, because he wanted to have a little chat with me and make sure that I knew what I was getting into before I agreed to be on the crew. But I was so dazzled just by the opportunity to be on the crew and go into space that I really don't remember very much of what he said. So there were large expectations, and I was insulated from most of the expectations that were put on me by the public and the media as a result of the one-year training that we went through. NASA did a very good job, actually, of making sure that everybody understood that I was supposed to be training because I was supposed to be learning these things, and that it was important that I did. And of course, it was very important to me that I understood my role really well and that I was really well prepared for the mission, because the last thing that I wanted to do was get into space and make a mistake. So I wanted to be very, very sure that I was able to meet the expectations.
Sally Ride spoke to reporters before the launch of Space Shuttle Challenger. She was asked many questions that male astronauts were not asked. Reports say she was asked if spaceflight would affect her ability to have children. She was asked whether she cried while working, or if she planned to wear makeup in space. She was also asked how she would deal with female health issues in space. The Soviet Union had already sent two women into space, one in 1963 and a second in 1982. Sally Ride said she was sorry a woman in space is such a big deal. In her words, "It's too bad our society isn't further along."
Sally Ride became a role model for young girls across the United States. She had just turned 32 years old. She was then, and remains, the youngest American ever sent into space.
It meant a lot to me to have the opportunity to go into space, and it meant a lot to me to be the first woman that was chosen. I didn't really think about it that much at the time, because I just wanted to get the opportunity to do that. But I came to appreciate what an honor it was to be selected to be the first woman to get a chance to go into space. And that's important to me, and I think that that it's something that I treasure, and I appreciate what an honor it was.
The Washington Post newspaper says Sally Ride reluctantly served as an idol of feminist strength and a hero of women's progress. It says she rarely spoke to reporters and did not like to be publicly recognized. She would not let NASA give permission to companies to sell products with her image or name on them.
Sally Ride flew on Challenger a second time in October of 1984. It was the 13th shuttle mission. On that flight, astronaut and classmate Catherine Sullivan became the first American woman to walk in space. Sally Ride spent a total of 343 hours, or about 14 days, in space. She was to have flown a third time, but the launch was canceled when the shuttle Challenger exploded on January 28th, 1986. She served on the committee that investigated that accident and the committee that studied the breakup of the shuttle Columbia in 2003. She was the only person to serve on both committees. She became known for asking difficult questions of people who met with the committees. Sally Ride also worked for NASA and helped with long-term planning. She became the first director of the space agency's Office of Exploration.
In 1987, Sally Ride went to work at Stanford University's Center for International Security and Arms Control. 2 years later, she became a professor of physics at the University of California, San Diego. She also served as a director of the California Space Institute, part of the University of California system. In 2001, Sally Ride formed a company called Sally Ride Science. It worked to help young people consider careers in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. The company helped train teachers to give high-quality science classes and provided materials about science to the teachers.
Sally Ride continued to serve the space agency. She was on a committee that advised NASA officials on human spaceflight. She also wrote or co-wrote at least 6 science books for children. They included a book called To Space and Back. She also wrote Voyager, An Adventure to the Edge of the Solar System, and The Third Planet, Exploring the Earth from Space. Sally Ride received many awards and was honored in at least 4 halls of fame. There were even 2 elementary schools named after her. One of her last projects involved working with university students to help boys and girls take pictures of the moon. They used cameras on 2 NASA satellites that were launched in 2011. It was part of her lifelong effort to persuade young Americans to study science.
Sally Ride died in California on July 23, 2012, after a 17-month-long battle with pancreatic cancer. She was 61 years old. In a statement announcing her death, Sally Ride Science said, "She lived her life to the fullest, with boundless energy, intelligence, passion, joy, and love." Surviving family members included her mother and a sister. Sally Ride was married to Steve Hawley, an astronaut, but they agreed to end their marriage after 5 years. She was also survived by Tam O'Shaughnessy. She was Sally Ride's partner from 1985 until the day she died. Like so much of her life, including the fact that she had pancreatic cancer, she had wanted to keep the relationship private. Sally Ride Science confirmed the relationship after her death.
In a statement, President Obama called Sally Ride a national hero and powerful role model who worked to persuade schools in the United States to teach math and science. He said that she inspired generations of young girls to reach for the stars. Sally's life showed us that there are no limits to what we can achieve. NASA Administrator Charles Bolden said, "The nation has lost one of its finest leaders, teachers, and explorers." In his words, "Sally Ride broke barriers with grace and professionalism and literally changed the face of America's space program."